This is Eagle 1490 AM WLCX La Crosse and streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Dave Packer. In the midst of the Amazon rainforest, President Biden making a U.S. commitment today, a finance coalition to restore deforested land.
History is literally watching us now. So let's preserve this secret place for our time and forever, for the benefit of all humanity.
Price tag, at least $10 billion by 2030. Donald Trump's nominee for Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth reportedly paid a settlement to a woman who accused him of sexual assault in 2017, according to his attorney. Hegseth's lawyer insisting that the allegations were false. Russia carried out one of its largest missile attacks in months, launching 120 missiles, 90 drones across Ukraine, the barrage targeting Ukraine's energy infrastructure. Outrage growing at the University of Oregon after a swastika was discovered in a dormitory hall. Jewish students, along with others on campus, condemning the incident as hate speech. Three people injured when a single-engine Cessna crashed this morning in Pomona, California. This is ABC News. An emotional and triumphant homecoming for a college football player a year after a personal tragedy.
Two summers ago, Carnell Tate's mother was killed in a drive-by shooting in Chicago. Saturday, the Ohio State receiver scored two touchdowns in their 31-7 win over Northwestern in Chicago, his hometown.
It was a lot of high emotions, stuff like that, but I had to manage it. It means a lot to be playing back in my city, especially my first time being back since my freshman year of high school, and especially being able to play in front of all my family and friends.
About 40 family members were at Chicago's Wrigley Field. Chuck Sievertson, ABC News.
And in a forthcoming book, Pope Francis is asking serious questions about Israel's military action in Gaza. ABC's Brian Clark has more.
Pope Francis is calling for an investigation to determine whether Israel's military action in Gaza constitutes a genocide. He has previously called the actions immoral and disproportionate, but this new step comes in an excerpt published from a forthcoming book of interviews that's due out next year.
I'm Dave Packer, ABC News.
The Dom Salvia Show.
Jeannie from Eau Claire.
I am thankful for Civic Media, the on-air talent, the technicians, the producers, the new staff, and especially Mr. Sage Wild. It's a very, very sad, shocking day for me, but I still have hope because I have hope in you guys. Keep up the great work.
Thank you, Jeannie. You give us hope. Appreciate you listening.
The Dom Salvia Show. Weekdays from 4 till 6 on the Civic Media Radio Network and on the Civic Media app.
Lena Bloom for The Bail Project.
Imagine you're stuck in a jail cell and you can't afford bail and someone offers you a way out. Just plead guilty and you can go home and kiss your kids goodnight. What do you do? What thousands have. You plead guilty whether you are or not. Cash bail makes poverty a crime. That's why The Bail Project helps those who can't afford it while fighting to end cash bail. Because freedom should be free.
Brought to you by the Ad Council.
This is your local Civic Media radio station. Want to hear even more? Anytime? Find all of it at civicmedia.us.
For Civic Media News, I'm Savannah Tome Olson. The recent wave of racist texts targeting Black Wisconsinites has sparked concerns about data privacy. Judith Rees Branch reports.
The personal information that people voluntarily disclose on various online platforms is often used for marketing purposes and can be sold to data brokers who then sell it to others. Cybersecurity professor Chad Johnson at the University of Wisconsin at Stevens Point says industry estimates are that most data brokers have no less than 15 data points on every American, including age and ethnicity, detailed contact information, and even social security numbers.
And since there's no regulation over who can buy those, of course, it could be other advertising agencies, it could be other platforms. But there's also nothing stopping, for example, a white supremacist movement from buying that information for purposes exactly like this.
Personal data can also be stolen or leaked. Johnson adds there is currently no comprehensive federal law that protects data and privacy in the U.S. However, Wisconsin's new data privacy law goes into effect next year. The Wisconsin Data Privacy Act includes requiring businesses to inform people if their data is being collected and the purpose, as well as the right to access that personal data and request that it be corrected or deleted. Johnson says the fact that anyone can have such detailed information about their targets is where the intimidation factor comes in.
It kind of sends the message also implicitly, well, what else could they possibly know? if they have my ethnicity, do they have my address? Do they have my children's names? Do they have my school or my children's school? It's impossible to know.
For Wisconsin News Connection, I'm Judith Ruiz Branch. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
And you're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Savannah Tome Olson.
Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. We'll see sunny to mostly sunny skies across the area for your Sunday. Light west winds, highs in the lower 50s. Tonight, mostly clear to partly cloudy skies. Lows will drop to the lower 30s. Here comes some showers on Monday, highs in the lower 50s.
Right now, it's 55.
Pete Schwabba.
On the next Nightlight, I welcome Madison filmmaker and musician James Runde. And Civic Media host Earl Ingram joins the show to talk about his favorite film noirs. Let's light it up.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba. Weeknights from 6 till 8.
You're listening to The Eagle, WLCX, La Crosse's home for Up North News Radio.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome to Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel, Civic Media's weekly review and discussion of some of the most significant news stories in the areas of law, government, courts, and the aspiration for justice. And now, here's your host, Jim Santel.
This is Amicus, a law review, the second hour of our weekend broadcast. Glad to have you with me for this second hour. We're spending most of our time this weekend talking about the U.S. Department of Justice, what it does, what its mission is on behalf of you, the people of the United States of America, the role that the Attorney General plays in advancing, promoting, yes, broadly, the missions, the identified goals of the president, but not doing that in a way that identifies particular people, at least not up until now. That has not been the tradition, with, admittedly, a few little glitches here and there. And so we do all of this to help you understand in greater detail and encourage your further exploration of what it is the U.S. Department of Justice does. You can go online, type in the United States Department of Justice, Justice Department, DOJ, it'll all pop up, and you can identify in your particular area of interest specific information about what, for example, the Environment and Natural Resources Division does. What the Antitrust Division does, what the Criminal Division does, what the National Security Division does, what the DEA, the ATF, the FBI, all of them, what do they do inside the Department of Justice? What does the Community-Oriented Policing Services do? What does the Community Relations Service do? What does the Office of Justice Programs do? And why is all of that important? It's because the Attorney General is responsible for overseeing, managing, in many ways directing the operations of all of those various agencies and litigation-specific assignments inside the United States Department of Justice, not just in Main Justice, but also in the U.S. Attorney's offices and other offices in major cities around the country. It is not the case. Department of Justice is just out there in Washington, D.C. It's right here in Wisconsin. Two major offices and lots of other satellite offices when it comes to the FBI, the DEA, the ATF, all these other investigative agencies inside the Department of Justice. And that's why it is so important to understand what the Department of Justice does in concert with appreciating and evaluating, assessing, as we all can and should do, the attempted nominees, the intended nominees of this president to occupy those positions. We know that just this past week, President-elect Donald Trump named former Representative Matt Gaetz, who has been a Republican representative from the state of Florida, as his nominee for attorney general. It is undeniably a provocative move. And installing at the helm of the United States Department of Justice somebody who may in fact be the person who accomplishes what Donald Trump has said that he is going to be. And that is retribution, your retribution, my retribution for things that have gone on in America. Those are his words. I'm going to be your retribution, he has said. And maybe, just maybe, that's the commission he's going to be giving to Matt Gaetz. We hope not. We hope that, consistent with the tradition of the Department of Justice, that this attorney general, if he is confirmed, will adopt and pursue that arm's length relationship and will not be retributive when it comes to who it is who's prosecuted, who it is who is on the receiving end of litigation. The pick undeniably identifies Matt Gaetz. He's 42 years old. He was the focus, significantly, as you probably know well, of a three-year federal investigation by the Department of Justice, by the FBI, the very agencies that he will now oversee, maybe. 2020, at the end of Donald Trump's first term, Justice Department and the FBI opened an investigation to claims that Gaetz, he is a sitting congressman at this time, was involved several years earlier with a minor, a young girl, 17 at the time. Investigators sought to determine whether Gaetz had effectively paid for sex in violation of federal sex trafficking laws. Always have to have a basis upon which to initiate an investigation. They plainly had it here. And they investigated this for about 3 years, ultimately concluding, probably because, reading the tea leaves on this, that for various reasons, the witnesses, including maybe the principal witness, the victim witness here, now well beyond 18, but at the time of making the decision, 18 years old, probably determining that she would not be a compelling witness, a maybe not even a believable witness when it comes to presenting a case to a grand jury and arguing that the government has proven its case beyond a reasonable doubt to a jury that would have to decide unanimously that they had met that burden. The Department of Justice determining in the end that perhaps while the events happened, not a sufficiently strong case against Matt Gaetz to bring that to a grand jury, to result in a grand jury indictment, to ultimately schedule a trial on those cases. And so never charged them. Matt Gaetz never charged for any of that in the federal system. Gaetz, of course, repeatedly said in the media he did nothing wrong, denied emphatically that any of these charges were true. Promised to fight back if indeed there was an indictment. There never was. And so the case itself was not prosecuted formally by the Department of Justice, closed after 3 years. But that's not to say that other things have not happened here. Plainly, Gaetz has also been under investigation by a parallel group. They're not responsible for prosecuting, but that group is the House Ethics Committee, member of the House of Representatives, subject to ethics oversight by the House Ethics Committee. That about since 2021, that case, House investigators, by all reports, were looking into similar allegations, sexual misconduct, maybe illicit drug abuse and use, all those things, again, in violation of federal law, but just more generally conduct that may be in opposition to the standards set forth for people who are representing us in the United States Congress. Allegations there also about sharing inappropriate images or videos on the House floor. That's a part of the focus, according to a lot of reporting about what the House Ethics Committee has been looking at. Arguably misusing some state identification records. Likewise, in his role as a United States representative, converting campaign funds to his personal use, all of those things that may or may not have also been a part of the Department of Justice investigation that resulted in no prosecution. But the subject of parallel investigative work by the House Ethics Committee and its staff. And we know well that the House Ethics Committee was planning to release a critical report on all of that as late as this past Friday. Just this past Friday, announcing that it's going to be having a hearing on Capitol Hill, announcing, releasing this report of what it thought would be a sitting member of the House of Representatives, Matt Gaetz. In fact, a couple of days before that, in Wednesday of this past week, as we all know, the president-elect of the United States of America announced that Matt Gaetz would be his nominee for the chief federal law enforcement officer for the United States of America. And almost contemporaneous with that, Matt Gaetz resigned from the House of Representatives, bringing his term of service to the people of Florida to an end there in the United States Congress, effectively under House rules, bringing to an end also the jurisdiction that House Ethics Committee has over him. And so the hearing never happened late this past week. The report was never released. We do not know what it would have said, at least not yet. There have been great calls, as you also know, from the public, from the media, from maybe members of the population generally as well, maybe you among them, calling for the release of this report for a couple of reasons. One, the information generally significant to know, a former government employee whose conduct plainly was the focus of a federal investigation, a criminal investigation, also the focus of an ethics non-criminal. Nobody goes to jail as a result of the House Ethics Committee report. Had it been released, had the committee moved forward on it, they may have sanctioned a member. They may have done other things to tell him, we do not approve, we sanction, we do not condone what you have done, and could apply house rules. None of that involving criminal convictions or time in prison. But there is interest out there in all of this, heightened hugely by the fact that there may be and certainly appears to be a huge amount of interest in the other branch, the other chamber of the Congress. That's the United States Senate. Why? Because now, as a result of the announcement of Matt Gaetz as Donald Trump's nominee, now we know that the Senate committee, the Senate Judiciary Committee, in addition to the House work in the ethics area, the Senate Judiciary responsible for determining whether or not to recommend the confirmation of Matt Gaetz to the full Senate. The Senate, under its advise and consent responsibility, the Article 1 of the Constitution of the United States of America, also implicit in Article 2, the executive branch, the president nominates, the Senate confirms or not under an advise and consent authority, and planning, presumably, to have that hearing with respect to the nomination of Matt Gaetz. Is it relevant for that Senate committee now to have that report from the House Ethics Committee? I would offer absolutely yes. It is information being held by a group of people literally right down the hall in that same building, the Capitol building of the United States of America. You can walk down the hall from one side of the Senate side of the Congress to the House side, and you can pick up that report plainly. It's in electronic form, can get it easily. Is it relevant for members of the United States Senate determining whether or not this candidate for the position of attorney general, determining whether or not that candidate is qualified to have that report? That report, that again, is not an indictment. It is a report of the summary of the investigative work done by the House in these various areas. I would argue that it's hugely important. And indeed, senators on both sides of the political aisle are this weekend and previously asking for that report. Significantly, the Speaker of the House of Representatives, his name is Mike Johnson, has said, nope, not giving it to you. The House Ethics Committee work in this area is done. The issue probably not done, probably not resolved. The issue is certainly not going away, especially as the nomination continues to move maybe toward some Senate review. Again, mentioning this notion of a possibility of a recess appointment, which would prevent the Senate from doing its advise and consent process in a routine way, maybe a story for the coming days to be resolved. But the issue of Matt Gaetz, the nomination of him, and the interplay with his past history, at least suggesting that he may have violated federal law, the very federal laws that he will be obligated to enforce, overseeing agencies that have investigated him, overseeing the very agency that was the recipient of this information about his arguably illegal conduct. We hasten to add, as we always do, no conviction, no finding of guilt here. That happens only if a jury determines guilt beyond a reasonable doubt after a trial, not here, but appropriate, because this process is not a criminal process. It's a political process. And Matt Gaetz should be the subject of Senate review. As Amicus Law Review continues, we'll talk about the other nominees being presented by the president-elect to the American people and to the Senate for consideration inside the Department of Justice.
You're listening to The Eagle, WLCX, La Crosse's home for Matinee on Air.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba.
John Legend, ladies and gentlemen. John, you and I have something in common because your last name is Legend and you're an actual legend. And my last name is Schwabba and I'm an actual Schwabba. So there you go.
Now, what is a Schwabba? You have to explain.
I'm a work in progress, but as soon as I figure it out, I'll let you know.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba. Weeknights from 6 till 8 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app.
Not completing high school is more of a social thing than it was an academic thing.
Even though all these years have passed, I still had that longing to have my diploma.
At age 30, Carissa finished her high school diploma.
If you're even considering getting your high school diploma, you can do it.
No one gets a diploma alone. If you're thinking of finishing your high school diploma, you have help. Find free adult education classes near you at finishyourdiploma.org. That's finishyourdiploma.org. Brought to you by the Dollar General Literacy Foundation and the Ad Council.
This is the Talk of La Crosse, Eagle 1490 AM.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
My name is Jim Santel. This is Amicus a la Review. Talking today in this special version of Amicus, all about the Department of Justice, interfacing now with these decisions by the president-elect to appoint various people, including Matt Gaetz, to the highest position of law enforcement in our land, the attorney general position. Matt Gaetz, not a lot, if any, litigation experience, spending most of his time recently in the United States Congress. Matt Gaetz, the nominee, nonetheless, by the president-elect to occupy this major position, do not have to be present employees of the Department of Justice to be nominated for these positions. It is not the case. You have to rise through the ranks. Many people do. Janet Reno, for example, not a part of the federal Department of Justice, but the attorney general, or rather the district attorney for many years in Florida, Dade County, doing a lot of work there in the area of law enforcement. A prosecutor understands the policies and the principles of a prosecutor, understands litigation, both civil and criminal. And so when Bill Clinton many years ago tapped her to become the attorney general, coming in from the outside, but she knew about the basic processes of the Department of Justice, an active lawyer in court. And so questions plainly beyond his immediate past history, whether or not he qualifies based upon arguably unproven, but nonetheless somewhat evidentiary support for this notion that he was engaging in some kinds of criminal activity, whether that qualifies him or disqualifies Matt Gaetz from being in that position. Other questions about simply your capacity to oversee this huge organization in all these areas that we talked about a couple of segments ago. In that same category, the president-elect has also nominated three people in other positions that we've also not now just talked about: the deputy attorney general, the principal associate deputy attorney general, the PADAG, kind of the chief of staff for the deputy attorney general, and also the solicitor general of the United States of America, the person sort of fourth in command who charges and goes forward with cases in front of the Supreme Court, argues to the Supreme Court on behalf of the people of the United States of America, the positions adopted by and advanced by the administration. And so who are those other people? Well, the other three that the president-elect has nominated are all in the category of people who serve presently as his private attorneys who have represented him, two of them in the criminal cases that are still pending against him, and one of them in other matters as well. Let's talk about them one by one. Todd Blanche, B-L-A-N-C-H, a lawyer who oversaw Donald Trump's criminal offense in at least three of these criminal indictments, these three criminal cases. He's tapped to become the number two position in the Department of Justice, the deputy attorney general. He is a former prosecutor in Manhattan, so he has that background. He is a trial attorney. He's a defense attorney. And so he's got those kinds of good credentials. He knows what he's doing. He's been inside a courtroom. He has also been, along with another nominee, formerly an assistant United States attorney in the Southern District of New York. He has been inside the Department of Justice before for that very reason. And along the way, of course, the history now is that Todd Blanche has represented Donald Trump not only in general matters, but also in that case that is going to take some headlines again this coming week. We know that this coming week on Tuesday, if he keeps to his calendar, Judge Juan Merchan is going to be announcing his decision on whether or not that Supreme Court case involving immunities for a president applies to the criminal prosecution, the criminal conviction that our president-elect suffered way back in May, finding that he violated 34 different instances of New York law. In that matter, Todd Blanch has represented Donald Trump. Now, you may say, well, gee, got a verdict there by a unanimous jury, beyond a reasonable doubt, that Donald Trump was guilty, but represented him effectively, advocated for his position there in court, and also stood by him as he did those impromptu or maybe not so impromptu press conferences outside the Manhattan Criminal Court. Todd Blanch representing Donald Trump in that case and presumably will represent him going forward in the days just ahead, not only as Juan Merchan announces his opinion, but also on schedule to sentence Donald Trump, Todd Blanch's client, Donald Trump, on November 26, right before Thanksgiving. That is also on the schedule. Todd Blanch scheduled to appear with his client, Donald Trump, in those dates coming up here in November. Todd Blanch also named by his client, the future president of the United States of America, to be Donald Trump's deputy attorney general. We'll get back to that in just a moment or so. The president-elect has also identified a couple of other people. Emile Bove, B-O-V-E, who has also served next to Todd Blanch at those counsel tables in those criminal cases, including the case in New York in which Donald Trump is found guilty of those New York offenses. He has been nominated. He has been identified as the principal associate deputy attorney general, basically the chief of staff, if you will, to the deputy attorney general, has a huge amount of administrative responsibility inside the Department of Justice, again, for overseeing, managing the department, as does the deputy attorney general. Very important, a right hand, a left hand person right there. Again, according to all of the organizational structure of the Department of Justice historically and anticipated for this administration, anticipating that will happen, Emile Bove, this coming week and next week, sitting next to his client, Donald Trump, in that New York courtroom, as he has done in other settings in which Donald Trump has been charged with criminal offenses, sitting next to his client, who will become the president of the United States of America, now indicating that he is going to identify and nominate and place in the position of the paydag the attorney who is in part representing him in those cases. His name, Emile Bove. And then we've got a third one. His name is D. John Sauer, S-A-U-E-R. He has not been representing the president, the future and past president, in connection with these criminal cases, but he did represent Donald Trump before the Supreme Court in arguing what? That the former president was entitled to these broad immunities. And indeed, Mr. Sauer was successful, right, in convincing the Supreme Court that Donald Trump should be immune from prosecution, at least presumptively immune for many things, and absolutely immune for the engagements with the U.S. Department of Justice. John Sauer representing Donald Trump, who is now appointing him to the position of Solicitor General of the United States of America. John Sauer representing him in that case, also representing Donald Trump on the appeal of the E. Jean Carroll sex assault defamation case, that matter now in appeal. He worked for Josh Hawley for many years when Josh Hawley was the attorney general in the state of Missouri. He was also a clerk to Antonin Scalia. All three of these trial attorneys, all three of these people who know their way around the courtroom, all three of them plainly, with respect to some aspects of the cases against Donald Trump, successful. We know that at least those two other cases, the case in Mar-a-Lago, the case involving election interference in the District of Columbia, those will almost certainly go away. Those will not see the light of day. And to the extent that Todd Blanch and Emile Bove and others were responsible for the strategy that promoted the delay in those, they have been successful. And Donald Trump, their future boss as the president, will benefit from that legal counsel, that legal advice for years to come. When we continue, some more discussion about why those issues should be on your mind as we think about the nominees going forward for the Department of Justice here in the United States of America.
You're listening to The Eagle, WLCX, La Crosse's home for Nightlight with Pete Schwabe.
ABC News, I'm Dave Packer. In the midst of the Amazon rainforest, President Biden making a U.S. commitment today, a finance coalition to restore deforested land.
History is literally watching us now. So let's preserve this secret place for our time and forever, for the benefit of all humanity.
Price tag, at least $10 billion by 2030. Donald Trump's nominee for Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth reportedly paid a settlement to a woman who accused him of sexual assault in 2017, according to his attorney. Hegseth's lawyer insisting that the allegations were false. Russia carried out one of its largest missile attacks in months, launching 120 missiles, 90 drones across Ukraine, the barrage targeting Ukraine's energy infrastructure. Outrage growing at the University of Oregon after a swastika was discovered in a dormitory hall. Jewish students, along with others on campus, condemning the incident as hate speech. Three people injured when a single-engine Cessna crashed this morning in Pomona, California. This is ABC News.
Your news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app.
The Bucks lose in Charlotte. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with Sports. NBA, the Bucks lost to the Hornets 115 to 114 after Giannis was called for a foul on LaMelo Ball. Later, the referees admitted they'd made a bad call after seeing the video postgame. Head coach Doc Rivers.
I thought the final play was the ref blowing a call, where on the final play, there's been an incorrect call made. LaMelo Ball fell. He just fell down. Nobody was near him, slipped on his own. We come up with the ball, the game's over.
The Bucks are now 4-9. College football, the Badgers had the lead, but lost to number one ranked Oregon, 16-13. Wisconsin unable to finish against Penn State and USC earlier this season.
We've been in these situations, we've been close, and we've played some great teams, and it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter whether it's the top-rated team in the country or whoever, and you got to find ways to finish and win football games, and you know that seems to be eluding us in the most critical moments.
That's Badgers head coach Luke Fickell. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
This is your hometown radio, refreshed, keeping you informed, entertained, and connected locally across the Civic Media Network.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. We'll see sunny to mostly sunny skies across the area for your Sunday. Light west winds, highs in the lower 50s. Tonight, mostly clear to partly cloudy skies. Lows will drop to the lower 30s. Here comes some showers on Monday, highs in the lower 50s.
Right now, it's 55.
Max Inc. on Civic Media with Mike and Wendy from Sunspot.
Can you imagine the mosh pit on the bridge that could happen?
Oh, well, that's how the original series was when they moved the camera. Whenever it's like the red alert, the
right?
Yeah, that was the mosh pit.
Yeah. And everybody had to like fake like
right, lean yeah, left, straight. Lean right.
Yeah.
Join us for all the fun with Max Inc. on Saturday night, 6 to midnight, across the Civic Media Radio Network and on the Civic Media app.
The Maggie Dawn Show.
Tom, your thoughts.
I don't believe that people don't know who Trump is at this point, and they have willfully decided to ignore everything he has said in order to vote what they think is the most important thing. And that's what voting is all about. But you can't claim ignorance when it comes time that Trump is going to pull the trigger and do some things that are going to hurt you and your family. That's what's probably going to happen.
Yeah.
The Maggie Dawn Show, weekdays from 2 till 4 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app. The Todd Alba Show.
If you haven't tried mindfulness techniques before, the idea is to take a minute, focus on the present, not the past, not the future. Be here now. You can do it in your car.
Please, not while you're driving.
I would say preferably not driving. Just take a moment and close your eyes and just breathe. Focus like on the breath coming into your body and out.
The Todd Alba Show, weekdays noon till 2 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
Doctors Without Borders is delivering life-saving medical care where it's needed most in communities around the world. From bandaging war-wounded patients in Sudan to providing clean drinking water in Haiti, we're in more than 70 countries worldwide, bringing patients from sick to recovering, from emergency to aid, from crisis to care. This life-saving care is made possible by a global movement of supporters like you. Thank you.
Todd Alba.
Hey, everybody, join us next time as we'll be joined by President of the Union, Reed Galen, also a founder of the Lincoln Project. Join us.
The Todd Alba Show, weekdays noon till 2.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
This is Amicus, a law review. My name is Jim Santel, and we are spending most of our time in this weekend broadcast talking about the U.S. Department of Justice and considering the merits, the demerits of the applications, the proposals by the incoming president-elect to place in various positions inside the Department of Justice, positions of great responsibility and authority affecting your life and mine, the lives of everybody that you know. In these positions, various individuals, including Matt Gaetz, the now former representative from Florida, question about whether his qualifications generally require a further review by the United States Senate. The answer to that should be yes, they should definitely review it, question whether or not they should pass favorably upon that nomination, whether the Senate Judiciary Committee should endorse that, whether the Senate itself should confirm him if indeed that comes to pass. We know that the president has also identified others outside of Maine Justice, outside of the Justice Department, Tulsi Gabbard to be the Director of National Intelligence, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. to be the Secretary of Health and Human Services, Pete Hegseth to be the Secretary of Defense, others out there raising similar concerns about whether or not their backgrounds, their recent histories, the things they have said about the very organizations that they will be supervising and the subject matters of those agencies, whether that sort of makes them unqualified or more accurately anti-qualified for those positions. The assumed nomination going forward of Matt Gaetz, subject to that important review under the Constitution by the United States Senate, many of them saying already that they may not vote for him, but nonetheless embracing the process. We'll see what happens there. Also embracing the process for Donald Trump's other nominees in those other areas and other positions inside the Department of Justice, including Todd Blanche for the number two position, Deputy Attorney General, Emile Beauvais as the Principal Associate Deputy Attorney General, and John Sauer to be the Solicitor General, the person who argues cases before the Supreme Court. Now, they are all qualified as lawyers. They're all qualified as prosecutors, some of them obviously inside the Department of Justice. They've practiced in private practice as they do now. They know their way around a courtroom. And indeed, one has to say that Todd Blanche and Emile Beauvais and other members of their team have been successful in representing Donald Trump in at least two, if not more, of those cases. Two of those cases, the federal cases, will never see the light of day. They have been successful through the delays that they have accomplished by raising these issues of immunity and other things in keeping Donald Trump from going to trial. Almost certainly, one way or another, those cases will go away in the next several weeks. And so successful lawyers, and do not in any way mean to indicate that their aggressive and effective advocacy is something to be critical of. Just the opposite. Defense attorneys are incredibly important to our system. Here's the concern, and is the concern that my former colleague, Barbara McQuaid, who was, when I was U.S. attorney in eastern Wisconsin, she was the U.S. attorney in Detroit in eastern Michigan. Barbara McQuaid recently said that as to these other three, it doesn't bode well. It doesn't bode well, and I would embrace that classification as well. Three reasons why. And again, subject to your own assessment, my opinions, my views, based upon the nominees and the roles that they would play inside the U.S. Department of Justice. Number one, simply the appearance of awarding your personal private attorneys with great jobs. These are important positions. They're also positions of great notoriety and esteem and regard. For all Americans, simply looking at this, this appears to be a big thank you. I will give you a job inside my administration for keeping me out of prison, for keeping these cases at bay, and on a very superficial but important level, it simply strikes me, and I suspect many people, as simply the appearance of impropriety that a president is now turning around and appointing his attorneys, his private attorneys, to positions inside government because he can, and saying to them, thank you for doing the job well of keeping me out of prison. Now you get a government job. Not nepotism. They're not related to him. This is not like appointing your son-in-law or your daughter to positions inside the White House. But it does have that appearance. And that raises the second issue about the relationship. We know plainly from all the reporting that at least John Blanche and Emile Beauvais and others had to have a very close relationship with Donald Trump during all of this. They also had a close attorney-client relationship
We'll get back to that in just a moment or so. And in that connection, plainly huge amount of communications between them, a relationship undeniably that is legal in nature, that is professional in nature. We don't know if it's personal with a capital P or a small p, but plainly a unique connection between Blanche and Beauvais and the future president of the United States of America. If indeed Donald Trump tends to make good on his promise to engage in retribution, I am your retribution, he has said, it may well be that Matt Gaetz will be the person who accomplishes that generally. The people to whom you call in Washington, D.C., inside Main Justice, if that's your goal, those are the attorney general, the deputy attorney general, the PAYDAG. It's these various people who have had this very close relationship with Donald Trump during the time of their representation of him in these various settings. Those are the people that the president calls, picks up the phone and says, do this. And in so doing, abrogates and destroys what we have talked about previously here this weekend and so many other times, abrogates that arm's length relationship. The fact that they have had this relationship, continue to have it to this day, presumably into next week and the weeks ahead as the sentencing goes ahead in New York, other things happen with respect to those criminal cases. That relationship is so close that one wonders if the arm's length relationship that should be established between the White House and the Department of Justice could in any way exist when they already have a very close personal relationship. I always speak about the non-relationship that Bill Clinton had with Janet Reno. They didn't like each other very much, and that was a good thing. Here you've got just the opposite. Is it too close for the connection, the arm's length connection, admittedly, but the connection between the White House and the Department of Justice to be appropriate? And not to encourage the kinds of directives that a president could do with respect to specific kinds of prosecutions against rivals, specific people filing civil lawsuits against them. No separation of just a relationship nature. That's the second reason why my colleague and I, Barbara Quaid, say this doesn't bode well. And the third one is kind of wonky. And it's really inside that representation issue. And we don't know a lot about, we will never know anything about the nature of the communications between Donald Trump and his attorney. But we do know that there was an attorney-client relationship there. We know with absolute certainty that Donald Trump, protected by the attorney-client relationship now and for all time, unless there is some rare exception, some crime-fraud exception that breaks into it, but unlikely here, unlikely. We know that Donald Trump told his attorneys, Todd Blanche, Mr. Beauvais, others in his team, things of a confidential nature. We don't know what those are. We don't know if they were admissions. We don't know if they were denials. We don't know what kinds of things he may have said about things related to the case in New York, those other cases in South Florida, the other case in Washington, D.C., the interference case. We don't know the content. We don't know what kinds of things the present and future and past president may have said to his attorneys, cloaked by, shielded by the attorney-client privilege, never to be disclosed. But they know things. They plainly know things about the man, the individual who's going to be occupying the West Wing and the White House and the Oval Office in particular. What if Donald Trump disclosed to them something in that confidential relationship? We don't know what. Wildly speculative on my part, I recognize that somehow becomes relevant, somehow becomes important to their work. Now, not as is counsel, but as operational people responsible for the Department of Justice, as the heads of the Department of Justice representing you, representing the people, no longer the person who's occupying the presidency, their former client. What if they know something that at some point becomes relevant? What if the president says or does something that prompts them to remember something that they told him, that he told them? In the context of that attorney-client relationship that presents maybe, possibly a conflict of interest that probably only they will know about, something the president does that they look at and say, gee, that's different from what he told us in the client relationship. That's contrary to what we know about what he admitted to us, what he said to us, what he confided us while we were his attorneys. And then they have a conflict of interest. The conflict is just that they cannot disclose that. And at the same time, they're responsible to represent what your interests, the interests of the Department of Justice, the interests of the rule of law, and cannot disclose the things that they know may be, could be important to the administration of the Department of Justice. That's the concern. That's the not bode well part of this. Again, wildly speculative, but that's the kind of thing that the members of the Senate, members of the population at large, should be looking at in determining whether or not even these folks, the other three, are they qualified as lawyers? Sure they are. They've been prosecutors. They've been inside courtrooms. They've argued cases to the Supreme Court. Sauer himself knows well the inside and outside of the Supreme Court. Is he qualified to take on the role that Ted Olson took on during the Bush administration? That Elizabeth Perlegar right now is doing so exceptionally well? Of course he is. The question is whether that appointment raises these concerns about appearances that you have of an incoming president appointing his former defense attorneys, the attorneys who've represented him in these appellate proceedings. Does that strike you as problematic? And I would suggest to you that it should. And certainly should suggest to the members of the Senate who are looking at this that they need to ask questions, not breaching the attorney-client relationship. That would be inappropriate. But nonetheless, inquiring about whether or not that's a concern, not disclosing the information, but concern among these nominees. Very clear, of course, anticipating a question here that none of these attorneys can continue to represent the sitting president in his private capacity once they become and they encumber these various positions like deputy attorney general, like the paydag, like solicitor general. They cannot continue to represent him in any matters that may continue during his presidency, including those state cases, those state criminal matters in Georgia and certainly in New York as that goes up on appeal very lightly. Cannot do that. No one would permit that to happen. The president might like them to do so because they've been successful in accomplishing what he wanted them to do, but that cannot happen. But the issue is that prior representation. And with respect to Matt Gaetz, it is the prior investigative results not resulting in an indictment. The other information that's inside that report, all of that should come to the Senate Judiciary Committee in the times just ahead. They should conduct their hearings. They should not approve any of these people, including for many of the other positions for assistant attorneys general around the Department of Justice. No U.S. attorneys appointed by recess appointments, absent a review, in some ways big or small, by the Senate Judiciary Committee. We've got to approach this in the ways that James Madison contemplated we would do it, advise and consent of the Senate. That's the way that should happen. The American people should push back on this notion that recess appointments should be accomplished in a way that robs the United States Senate of the capacity to ask these questions of the Matt Gaetzes of the world, of the Tulsi Gabbards, of the RFK Juniors, of the Pete Hegsehs, and of the many other nominees, thousands of them, candidly, that are going to come before the Congress for approval or rejection in the days, weeks, months, and years ahead. All of that happening, of course, as we anticipate the coming time. We have talked at great length about the nominations and the Department of Justice. We have also talked about the Supreme Court and the connection between the Office of the Solicitor General and the Supreme Court, the fact that there is indeed going to be a change in that position, whether or not John Sauer is confirmed, there will be a change in administration and a change in the ways in which the Department of Justice, through that Office of the Solicitor General, advocates before the Supreme Court. We're going to talk more about the effects of a new Solicitor General, a new administration, upon the present term that has before it a great number of cases, 45 as of this weekend, in a great number of areas, environmental cases, commerce cases. There's that major transgender case coming up for argument in December. We have also already had the argument involving firearms in America, the case involving the future of an ATF regulation. As we continue, we'll talk more about that and also other cases involving the United States Supreme Court here on Amicus, a Law Review.
You're listening to the Talk of La Crosse, Eagle 1490 AM. Hey there, it's Carrie Joy with your Work Money Minute. Today, I want to talk about a couple of things to keep in mind when you're between jobs or when money is scarce. Number one is a reminder that most of us are already tracking. As best you can, only use credit in emergencies. You know, like a medical emergency or when your only car breaks down. Try your best not to use them for everyday type expenses. That could cost you a lot more over time. Now, number two, if you know you're going to have a hard time paying your creditors, talk to them right away. You know, have those conversations before you fall behind on your bills. They might accept a partial payment. They might be willing to work out some other arrangement with you while you're in a tough spot. And yeah, nobody likes having those conversations, but it's better than the stress of avoiding creditors later. That's today's Work Money Minute. For more everyday money tips, check out Work Money Media on YouTube. Till next time, this is Carrie Joy saying, take good care.
You're listening to The Eagle, WLCX, La Crosse's home for the Todd Allball Show.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
This is Amicus, a law review, as always, inviting your questions and your inquiries into our discussion this weekend, no exception to that. Mark, you've been on the line for a long time. Glad to have you with us this weekend on Amicus. Your question, your comment, your observation.
Yeah, it's amazing to me that Donald Trump, you know, is going out for retribution now, and clearly thinking about it logically, if indeed the Biden administration had been going after Donald Trump in retributive fashion, you know, Donald Trump would be in jail right now. I mean, if he would have unleashed the full power of law enforcement upon Donald Trump and his allies, they would currently be in jail or detained someplace unpleasant. What is remarkable to me is that Donald Trump supporters are going full along with one of the things that we broke with England for. Is that basically under English code of justice, I mean, the king just said, judges, do this for me, and it was done. I mean, they served at the king's pleasure. That corruption in office has been anathema to justice or to government going back to antiquity. I mean, the story I've mentioned before is the case of Ximenes and Cambyses II, when Cambyses II found out that his judge, Ximenes, was... taking bribes, he had the man executed in a most unpleasant fashion. That how a Supreme Court, the sophistry that they have engaged in to allow, you know, calling bribes now their gratuities, and to say that a president is immune when clearly the founders they rejected the idea of presidential immunity wholeheartedly, because that was one of the fears that the Anti-Federalists proposed, that they would just establish a monarchy here, and we cannot have that.
Absolutely.
That's
the key. And frankly, as you know well, Mark, that's exactly what at least the dissenters in that immunity case said. Sonia Sotomayor saying, again, we've got a loaded gun sitting there in the Oval Office ready to go off. And arguably, again, she wasn't speaking about the specific physical use of a weapon, although she did present some options now that a president would have as the king, some of which you have made reference to historically. She ended her piece saying, I'm fearful for democracy. And I take it away that take from your comments this weekend that that's your concern as well. And so, Mark, appreciate very much the comments and the historical perspective, which, again, prompt us all to think about the incoming administration, how it's going to handle these newfound powers and specifically through the people put in positions of responsibility. Mentioned before, of course, that the Solicitor General is one of those people going to be encumbering the office of the Solicitor General inside the Department of Justice. Why is that important? The position of Solicitor General not only argues but also articulates in memorandums and briefs positions of the administration. There are two cases pending right now before the Supreme Court that will almost certainly be changed in the 65 days or maybe 70 days or so yet ahead, 65 days before Donald Trump takes the oath of office, and presumably some of these folks continue move through the process. One of those cases called Scrimeti. It's a transgender rights case. It's a challenge brought by the Biden administration to a Tennessee law that bans medical treatments for transgender minors. Scheduled to be argued right now, still in December, next month.
And the law also challenged a separate lawsuit by families and a doctor. The justices granted only the Biden administration's petition in that case to be reviewed. Trump administration, with the new Solicitor General coming in, will almost certainly reverse course. And the court will sooner or later have to make adjustments if it decides the constitutionality of the law, a dramatic impact upon one of the major cases of this term based upon what the American people have decided, the change in the Solicitor General then that comes from that, and a change in the advocacy about transgender rights in America. Here's the other one that we've talked about. We have talked about this case called Garland versus Vanderstock. It's the case on ghost guns, argued in October. The Supreme Court seemingly awfully supportive of the ATF regulation that says, yep, we can regulate these things. You can get them through the mail, you can order them, and you can put them together. Yes, it's appropriate to have serial numbers on them. Appears that the Supreme Court was headed in the direction, haven't decided it yet, of supporting the DEA regulation that permits regulations of ghost guns and the manufacturers of that. Trump administration could render that moot, rescinding the regulation, changing the very underpinnings for the case itself. And, of course, that would change the geography not only of firearms in America, but the advocacy that goes on there in the Supreme Court. Many, many other instances, 45 other cases right now pending in front of the Supreme Court as of this week. Not all of them involve government interests, but many of them do. They just this past week granted certiorari in a number of other cases, things important to know, cases involving environmental issues. Oklahoma versus EPA, originating from the 10th Circuit, concerns whether the EPA has its final action under the Clean Air Act, where you challenge that kind of thing. Another case, EPA versus Calumet Shreveport Refining, concerns whether the Court of Appeals in the District of Columbia must be the venue for the claims of a small oil refinery. Some challenges there. Both of those things happening with respect to environmental cases. The Clean Air Act implicated by that, a thing called the Renewable Fuel Standard Program. Those cases are pending before the Supreme Court right now. They are newly welcomed, if you will, into the group of cases. The Supreme Court will decide. All of those, like many others, are also positions, cases in which the government has taken positions in favor of the EPA rules and the EPA positions. Will the new Solicitor General coming in about 65 days or so, or maybe shortly thereafter, reverse the positions of the present administration and abandon the EPA's position in favor of clean air and clean water and all the other environmental cases? A case recently given cert again in the Supreme Court called Louisiana versus Calais concerns the congressional map that the Louisiana legislature adopted in 2024. Now, that case probably not involving the federal government, but nonetheless, a case where if there is a related interest of the Department of Justice, of the government generally, we have seen this in all of the other gerrymandering cases, right? Many other situations where the U.S. Department of Justice has weighed in on these kinds of things. Many other cases out there. Cases argued just this past week. Velazquez versus Garland having to do with, again, in immigration issues, involuntary departure of immigrants under our federal system. A case called Delegati, which was also argued just this past week, involving minimum mandatory prison sentences. That's in a case involving the government centrally. The Solicitor General involved directly in that case, arguing before the Supreme Court just this past week. And another case involving securities fraud, likewise, of just this past week. All of those cases implicating the U.S. Department of Justice in deciding the positions of the Department of Justice. As we continue next week and in the weekends ahead, more discussion, more analysis of all of these things going to the rule of law, going to courts, and going to the administration of justice in our nation in 2020.
Eagle 1490 AM. Pat Kreitlow. On Monday's show, Pat Kreitlow makes his triumphant return back to Up North News Radio. We talk about his vacation and what happened in the news this weekend. Join us.
Up North News with Pat Kreitlow. Weekday mornings starting at 6.
What I know about courage, I learned from my adoptive mom. She said sometimes you just gotta hold on and know we'll get through this.
Mom, we are so high up. Hold my hand.
No, you hold my hand.
Here we go!
Learn about adopting a teen from foster care. You can't imagine the reward. Visit AdoptUSKids.org to find out more. This message is brought to you by AdoptUSKids, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, and the Ad Council.
You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram. Soaring high above La Crosse. This is Eagle 1490 AM WLCX La Crosse and streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.